papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So the Media Project gives you a half hour of commentary and analysis, hopefully some insight into newsroom decision making with some veteran news decision makers. And we hope you'll stay with us for the next half hour for what we promise will be an interesting conversation. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, now creating The Upstate American, as it's called, published by Substack. Let me introduce those joining me here today. Ira Fussfeld, the longtime, now retired publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York. Barbara Lombardo had been the executive editor of the Saratogian and the Troy Record, now teaching at UAlbany, and Judy Patrick, vice president of the New York Press Association and formerly editor of the Daily Gazette. Hello, friends. How are you?
You know, the gang's all here.
Here we are. Absolutely. Hey, speaking of old times, which we do being who we are, what a change this is, folks. WCBS, News Radio 88 in New York City, is no longer. There is no longer the 24-hour news signal. It's just a mark of the times, right?
It's a big loss. I remember when it started, when it went on the air in the late 60s. I listened to it. There was already a news radio station in New York, WINS, which had previously been a rock and roll station. Murray the K used to be on that station. But when I moved upstate to get the all-news station, you'd go to CBS because the signal was stronger.
Right.
And then when I went into the city, I invariably tuned to 88 because you'd want traffic and weather together on the 8s. But it was a great station, a big loss, and there's a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuvering regarding ownership. And what's one of the oddities of this station, this switch, is that the ESPN New York outlet is now going to be broadcasting on the CBS signal, but it puts it in direct competition. It's always been in direct competition, but even more so now with 66, which is WFAM, the predominant sports station, and the ownership is the same. So I'm not quite sure how they're working all that out, but it's a big loss. In a city the size of New York, one all-news station is not enough.
First of all, I'm not sure you moved upstate when you moved an hour north, but I don't want to get into that.
I moved upstate when I was living in the Bronx.
Upstate? Oh, yeah, there we go.
But let's not forget how important AM radio is in times of emergency, and a lot of people really relied on that station during Hurricane Sandy or Tropical Storm Sandy, which was devastating to that region, and it was crucial for that area getting through that crisis over many days.
But it's just a mark of how different the news environment is now from what it used to be. Nowadays, if you want to know what's going on, well, take out your phone, look at whatever is online.
And hope that somebody's actually providing the news that you want to see. Well, now there are cable stations with the 24-hour news, but you're not really getting news 24 hours or even 3 hours a day. You're getting rehash and talking heads over and over. And it's sad to see a station providing real news and real weather and up-to-the-minute reporting. Gone.
But as you point out, you know, I get very parochial or chauvinistic about this when I hear so much criticism and people almost gleefully talking about the demise of print. It's not just print that's going through this change. Here you have one of the major stations in the nation, in effect, going out of business because there are other places we can get your news.
Well, and that's definitely true. It's not just print. I mean, there have been more layoffs announced at New York Public Media, which is the public radio outlet, as well as now the online focused Gothamist, which is published by WNYC and WQXR, the classical station. Those are all public media, and they are laying off another 6% of their staff. The Boston Globe, which has made a major foray into podcasting, supposedly the medium that was going to trump all others, there is now a glut of podcasts. And so the Boston Globe has changed its mind and is backing off from what was one of its flagship podcasts, supposedly.
So. Is WQXR still owned by the New York Times?
No, that is now New York Public as well.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yep, same ownership there as WNYC.
What was odd about that podcast incident at the Globe, isn't that where they hired people to create something new, and before it even had a chance to get off the ground, they decided, no, we're not going to do that after all, but thanks for quitting your other jobs and coming to join us.
Yeah, you think they would have done some research about the viability of the podcast going forward before they invested a lot of time, money, and energy into this whole division that they created. But I mean, I could have told you the podcast market was glutted.
Yeah.
I don't have time. I'm sick of listening to podcasts.
Except for this one, of
course. Except
for
this one.
Yeah. We welcome anybody who listens here anytime at WAMC.org. Thank you very much. But yeah, the Boston Globe, for example, in order to sustain its readership on multiple platforms, has now expanded geographically. Special Globe bureaus in New Hampshire and Rhode Island. They have podcasts in Rhode Island, incidentally, so it's not as though they're totally abandoning podcasts. But this is interesting. It's like the Times Union expanding into the Hudson Valley and the Daily Gazette picking up Amsterdam and
Gloversville.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. These expansions are geographic in order to try to maintain some of the bulk that used to be more available locally.
I'd be curious, for obvious reasons, to find out whether or not the Times Union is happy with this process. I read the Times Union online every day, and there is a Hudson Valley component that's very evident on that site. And there are several stories, including more than just one or two, that my old paper didn't have that they had there. But I don't know what their measurement is. I don't see any particular gain in advertising from the region. So it comes back to the clicks and the number of people listening, and perhaps that's enough to say this is a success or not. But I'm curious to know whether they think they've been successful so far.
Well, we'll have to see if we can get someone speaking to a contemporary Times Union experience on here to give us some insight into it. Couldn't tell you. But it's an interesting change that has happened, that as some of the smaller market news organizations have had to constrict, their place is being taken by those with a little bit more heft in other geographic regions. But it does create this thing that we've spoken about before here, which is ghost newspapers, the possibility that you have a label without journalistic heft behind it. And there are a number of instances of that. We've talked before here about the Poughkeepsie Journal, which used to have a newsroom staff of about 60, which I believe now Poughkeepsie is basically covered by a single reporter, I think.
Yeah, they and the Times Herald Record, which used to be an independent newspaper as part of the Ottaway group, are sister papers now, and there's a lot of overlap between the two. And there's also, I believe, the editor of the Poughkeepsie Journal now is based in Rockland County or Westchester County. So
yeah.
And I'm not singling them out. That's the trend in the business.
Yeah, those were all significant newspapers. I almost became the editor of the Record in Middletown before I got the Times Union job. It was a
formidable competitor.
It was a great, yeah. It really did a great job, yeah. So we're interested in your thoughts, folks. If you have observations about how the media ecosystem is changing in your community, media@wamc.org is how you can intersect with the Media Project. I'm Rex Smith, here with Ira Fussfeld, Barbara Lombardo, and Judy Patrick. Speaking of changes in the industry, let's just turn to this one before we walk away from what was and what is now. The New York Times has announced that it is no longer going to endorse candidates in New York races, New York City and New York State. No longer will endorse in the mayoral race, in the U.S. Senate congressional or state legislative races, though it still will for races for the presidency. And it is a step away from what has been a tradition in American journalism. And I wonder what you all think of that. Judy, your paper, when you were the editor of the Gazette, went sort of back and forth on this issue.
Right. I'm really torn on it because for decades, when I was there, my first few decades there, we didn't endorse. And it gave us a measure of freedom from the election season. I mean, when you do endorse, you have to bring all the candidates in and you have to have a real conversation with them. And it's very time consuming. From a more philosophical perspective, I found that not endorsing was good because we gave the people the information and let them decide for themselves. On the other hand, which is me equivocating, I do believe that having a sophisticated journalist make a decision about what candidate would actually be best for a political job, I think there is great value in that. And the question is, you know, do papers have the resources? Clearly, the New York Times has the resources to do it. So I don't know what their thinking is about it. As a practical matter, for small papers going forward, I don't think they have the resources to do it well, because you need to do it well. You need to really have conversations, and you need to have thoughtful people with knowledge of the community make those kind of endorsements.
Hmm. I totally agree with Judy, on
which part? She took
all over.
On the equivocation, I think there's hubris on the part of the media that thinks, well, what we have to say is really important, and we're going to come down on the side of a candidate, and you need to listen to this, and we're going to use our very well-informed and balanced judgment to tell you why. So there's some arrogance in that. But at the same time, you hope that there is some informed opinions that are being presented that, you know, you want to know, what does the Times say? What does the Saratogian say? That you're hoping that you can turn to a trusted media source to help weigh your opinions. And you might read an editorial endorsement and decide, I don't agree with those policies or that person's character, and I don't want to. You might vote with the paper, you might vote against the paper, but you're looking for a trusted source, so it could be a good thing. On the local level, it's very difficult. We would, as Judy said, bring in all the candidates for all the positions that they were running for, and then sometimes you knew them and you could write and you had background and you had sourcing, but other times you felt it was a shallow endeavor to try to make a pronouncement on certain candidates you didn't really know that well.
Well, I'm saddened by it. Maybe it's because I'm a throwback and I'm an old-timer, but I believe the editorial page and the local editorials, including endorsements, are important roles that we have to fulfill as news organizations. I agree that they're time-consuming, and we should be careful if you're making an opinion and printing an opinion without all of the information, so you might have to pick and choose what races you're going to weigh in on. But I believe that, again, going back to the heyday, one of the things that people buy their local newspaper for was the editorial page, to get an idea about what the opinion of the editorial writers are or is.
Yeah, it's a leadership role for the news publication. And I felt very committed when I was there to writing, you know, 7 editorials a week, even if one day a week was maybe a thumbs up and a thumbs down. And I remember one of my editors had said, you know, Barb, we don't have to have something every day. This is too much. And it was like, no, we must have an editorial every day. This is part of our leadership role. And later, when our owners at one point wanted us to endorse on the national level candidates that I could not abide with, I suggested then maybe we shouldn't editorialize on candidates. It makes some of our readers mad, and it makes some of our advertisers mad, no matter who we pick. And this way we could play it more down the middle.
I consider this an abrogation of responsibility by the New York Times. I really think that making the blanket statement we're not going to endorse in the New York gubernatorial race, in the New York mayoral race, this is part of their community.
Yeah, we're looking for them for guidance.
Absolutely. This is the New York Times saying, you know what, we don't care about our geographic base anymore. We're a national, international publication, and that is not a good idea. You know, in the last New York City mayoral race, the New York Times stepped in and endorsed a woman named Catherine Garcia, who was the sanitation commissioner. And that was one of the reasons that she suddenly had a surge in fundraising. She had support. She came within a few thousand votes in New York City's ranked choice voting system of becoming the Democratic nominee, in no small part because of the thoughtful editorial support of the New York Times. And to be saying at this point, well, New York State doesn't matter, the city doesn't matter in terms of the opinion position, I just think that's a bad strategic move. Now, I understand the point that readers confuse the editorial positions with the independent journalism somewhat. And I've had this conversation with readers many times over the years where they say, well, we know who you support. And you try to say, well, but the reporters are different from the editorial board. The reporters aren't involved in this process. But that is hard to explain. And so it does affect, I suppose, the independent credibility of the news report. But on balance, though, I would weigh in support of the notion of giving people the advantage of, I think the notion when you said it's sophisticated, Judy, the sophisticated journalist, I heard people snorting all over the radio audience there. But I know what you mean by that, a thoughtful questioning on really substantive issues. We would really prepare for editorial board meetings. And when I was a reporter and bureau chief for Newsday, the editorial board was very thoughtful and sometimes would embarrass our reporting staff by being out ahead of us on topics that they were researching. So for a big newspaper like this, the New York Times editorial board has more than a dozen members. They have the capacity to do this, and they should take advantage of it.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't understate, and I'm not suggesting you did, but the phone calls that you said you had with readers who wouldn't accept the differentiation between the news coverage in the editorial coverage, it became an increasing problem, at least in my situation, where you didn't want to lose readers. You wanted to show your readership that you were fair and as honest as you could be. And nevertheless, if you endorse a Democratic candidate, that means that he must be getting favorable coverage in the news site. And that's a sense that permeated the relationship between our readers and the newspaper and pushed newspapers away from doing endorsements.
Yeah.
There's also something that an editorial can do that news coverage certainly can't do as efficiently, and maybe even other commentary can't do. And that's to synthesize maybe the gray areas of a candidate. You could list the pros and cons of policy by what's stated, but to also explain their demeanor, their character, their nature, their leadership abilities. Those are fuzzier things that could be forcefully expounded upon in an editorial.
Good point. Interesting.
And we're seeing more newspapers, including my old newspaper, not just stop endorsing candidates on the editorial page, but are not producing locally written editorials, period, anymore. And that's a responsibility I think we had as a newspaper in the community to accept the leadership role. And unfortunately, resources is one of the key reasons for it.
Well, that is certainly just a mark of the times of how things have changed.
No pun intended.
Right. Okay, turning to this great feature, what would you have decided to give you some insight into something that was a significant, interesting decision that some journalists made in recent weeks? Let me just explain to our listeners. Last month, at some point, journalists at three major U.S. newsrooms began to get emails from an anonymous person who identified himself as Robert, who sent a trove of private documents from inside Donald Trump's campaign to journalists at Politico, at the New York Times, and at the Washington Post. So once these things came in from this anonymous individual using an AOL email address, these were internal communications and a research dossier that the campaign had put together on the guy who became Trump's running mate, Senator J.D. Vance. Here's what's interesting. Those were not reported upon. The substance of what they got still has not been reported upon, although those news organizations have revealed to readers that they did get leaked Trump campaign files, but they chose not to publish them. So here's my question. What would y'all have done, veteran newsroom leaders, should the media feel free to report on what are probably hacked campaign documents? Or were these organizations, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Politico, were they right to step aside and say, we're not going to use this?
Well, I think that the answer is yes to both of those. You do have the right to do it. You do have the right to publish it as long as the material was not stolen by you. But if the information came to you in a legitimate manner, you have the right to print it. But I think what these organizations must have done independently, because I don't see any collusion here, is vet the material and say, is this newsworthy? And if it's not newsworthy, then you don't print it just because you have it.
Wouldn't it be newsworthy to know what the Trump campaign was learning about the guy who became the vice presidential candidate? Wouldn't it be newsworthy to know some of that stuff in the file?
Yeah. On the surface, the answer is yes, but I don't know. You really have to look at the material to know.
So how big a role does the origin of content you get play in your decision to use it?
Minor. In the big scheme of weighing whether to use it or not, it's the newsworthy factor that I think has to be number one. A close second would be where did it come from, but that wouldn't be the make it or break it, the deal breaker for me.
Right. It seems like the news organizations in this instance did everything right. They reached out to the source and tried to find out more information, tried to vet it, and then they verified that it was actually real information, and then they alerted the FBI that this had happened. They made a decision that whatever was in there was not newsworthy. It's hard for us to know what exactly was in there. The other thing to keep in mind is there might be other information out there that they may be looking at right now. If they got the Vance vetting materials, what else did this hacker get and what else is he distributing? It may be that something else that comes over the transom will be newsworthy and they will report it. I don't think that they suppressed it because it was hacked. I think they didn't report it because they didn't think it was newsworthy.
Trump got plenty of airtime about the leak of the information, so this was a win-win for that side.
The interesting factor of deciding that you will use information notwithstanding its origin is something that I think the public probably doesn't understand, that we have no obligation as journalists to assure ourselves that the hands are clean of those who provide information to us. It is useful information, and you certainly cannot induce someone to illegally obtain information. In fact, if you do that, you, the newspaper, are liable, potentially criminally liable, you know, for hacking itself. If you, in fact, tell someone, hey, could you go into that email account and get me that information? That's something you really can't do as an editor.
And by the same token, if we were to confirm that material was provided to the media by hacking of a foreign government or foreign entities, we still might choose to use that information. It depends on what the information is, and it's a tricky call sometimes.
Yeah,
and sometimes it'd be not tricky at
right,
all.
And I think we're not ruthless about it. There have been times when information landed on our fax machine accidentally, and we investigated further, and it was accidentally sent to us, and we didn't use it because the person who sent it made a mistake, didn't intend to have this published, and we were a bit forgiving on that because it's something that was a mistake. I think if we accidentally discover things on a website, that's a whole different kettle of fish. But there are people in newsrooms that make these decisions about why things get leaked, whether or not it's newsworthy, what the motives of the people leaking are. But those are not the motives. Motivation isn't typically the supreme factor in deciding whether or not to use the story. But I think it's something you have to take into consideration.
Do you think that the four news organizations talk to each other before they decided not to print?
No, no I don't.
No,
I don't either.
I
but how is it known then? Was the story that broke didn't know that there were four news organizations.
Politico reported that it had gotten the leak, and then the other two, the Times and the Post, said, oh, what do you
us
know?
Us too.
So, yeah, we did too. Right. But we're a long way, I think, from 2016, when the Democrats' computers were hacked and we found out Hillary Clinton's travails and even some less useful information.
We tried to learn from our lesson, you think?
Maybe so. You know, but the notion of hacking having an impact on a race is significant, especially if it's foreign interests.
Yes, and as a journalist, I feel, and I wonder if my panelists, you know, share this feeling of sleaziness. Like you feel sleazy when you're taking, even if it's newsworthy information, but you're taking it from a source whose motives are not admirable.
Doesn't every source have a motivation, though, to talk to you? Isn't there some reason why somebody is going to give you information? And so I think it's just a question of weighing, of being a thoughtful journalist about the value of the content and understanding what the motivation might be.
And sometimes being transparent to with the readers about or listeners about where the information is coming from and how the decisions are being made.
You know, I'm just reminded, local listeners will remember the history of former Congressman John Sweeney, who was defeated by Kirsten Gillibrand in a race for Congress, in part because of reporting in the Times Union about his domestic abuse, about beating up his wife. Which information we knew about for months before we published it. We had a couple of human sources. And coincidentally, just a few days before the election, or not coincidentally at all, quite intentionally, someone finally gave us the documentation to back up our human sources inside law enforcement who gave us that information. It was a motivated individual, let's say, somebody with a partisan intent who finally came through with the documentation. But we didn't go with the initial story, and we found out that another news organization in the community, Electronic, was given fake information trying to offset what we had, trying to make us look bad. And of course, then Congressman Sweeney lied about it and went out to the public and denounced the Times Union before some months later finally agreeing that in fact it was true. So anyway, you get this stuff. You get stuff leaked to you, and you may sometimes hold off on it until you're able to confirm it or until you are satisfied that what you're doing is not merely being a tool.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth remembering that the reputable news organizations will go through a process of vetting and holding on to something that they would like to get in print or on the air, but they are not going to do it until they're sure. And I think the public needs to be reminded that there is integrity on most of the news organizations out there.
Finally today, Donald Trump is claiming that the media coverage of Kamala Harris's rallies are based upon AI-generated images. that crowds at her airport appearances didn't exist, that she, quote, AI'd it, that didn't exist. And that seems not to be true. But I wonder if we are not worried about AI images and about the fact that we may indeed be duped these days.
Now, those are two issues that you're raising. One is how to deal with Trump's lies about the size of the crowds. And how do we deal with what can you believe and how do you make sure that the public knows what they can believe?
Right.
I don't know the answer to that.
Well, the good news is there are scientists working on, you know, deciphering how AI generates images and so on. But news organizations being able to access that information and having the resources to do so, it's another matter. Which brings us to the end of our time here.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah, quick half hour.
Amazing.
You know?
Are you going to pound the table anymore, Barb?
Done? Don't make me pound the table.
Don't make her do it. You'll have to hear more of that next week, folks, if you come back. Ira Fussfeld, Barbara Lombardo, and Judy Patrick have been here. I'm Rex Smith. We are grateful to our producer, Dave Gustina, for making this possible. And we thank you for joining us. Hope you'll come back again next week for The Media Project.
It must have startled poor old Sadie's aunt. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian, and Daily Freeman publisher emeritus Ira Fussfeld. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.